This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Speak No Evil, a novel by Uzodinma Iweala. Performed by Prentice Oniyemi and Julia Whalen. Finally, he said, I have word from, and here he named the dear name, that I shall not come again. I saw the dead face and heard the unspoken words, no need to go to him again, even were it in your power. Samuel Beckett, Ohio Impromptu. No, it ain't nothing left to say. Odyssey, tomorrow today. Part 1. Niru. Chapter 1. The snow starts to fall just before Ms. McConnell's global literatures class. It is light at first and hangs in the air, refusing to stick to anything, and instead hovers about the bare tree branches shivering outside. I sit down across from the window with my back to the door like the rest of the boys. We all sit close to the door because of the walk across the cathedral lawn to get to class, and because no one wants to be the sole male body surrounded by girls. It never pays to seem like you're trying too hard. Ms. McConnell watches us remove our jackets and place our books on the desks. After the first week of the semester, she gave up on asking us to settle in quickly. Now she waits, with one fist gripping her pen and the other resting on her hip, until we're ready. I can't pay attention because Meredith isn't paying attention. She always sits directly across from me, with her back to the window and the row of pine trees blocking the view to Wisconsin Avenue. Normally she tries to make me laugh with her near-perfect micro-impressions of Ms. McConnell's exaggerated movements, but today she is half-turned to the window, her eyes towards the sky. I scan the room. No one pays attention. Some of us focus on the interesting trinkets from Ms. McConnell's world travels. She has spent time in Kenya and India teaching younger kids and older women how to read, so bright-colored kikoi cloths line her bookshelves, which host Guatemalan worry dolls and rusted iron bangles. My classmates think they're real, but I have a cousin in Nigeria who sells freshly made antiques to foreigners seeking to collect their own colonial histories. Sometimes Ms. McConnell burns incense and the room smells of sandalwood or cinnamon. It makes my nostrils tickle. I see it coming and try to warn Meredith, but she's completely lost. Ms. McConnell is silent as she watches Meredith contemplate the snow outside. Our classmates suppress giggles as Meredith chases snowflakes with small cat-like movements of her head. Earth to Meredith, Ms. McConnell says. Meredith starts and hits her knee against the desk in front of her. She yelps and winces. Everyone laughs, even Ms. McConnell, who asks, "What could possibly be more interesting than our riveting discussion in this classroom?" "It's really coming down," Meredith says. Ms. McConnell finally looks out the window and says, "Holy shit," and we all laugh. "Everyone, wait here for one second," she adds, before she slips into the hallway and the class lapses into uncontrolled chatter. Adam and Rowan rush to the windows. "Fuck yeah," they say almost in sync. I can see the soft flakes falling on the pine branches from where I sit. A strong wind stirs sheets of white in waves and circles. When Ms. McConnell returns, she has a pained look on her face, and I know that she's thinking about what a blizzard will do to her syllabus. Rowan looks at her and says, "Class is officially over." "Rowan," Ms. McConnell shouts, but he is already halfway out the door. I think, how the fuck am I going to get home? "You can come to mine," Meredith says as we watch the layers of snow build. I call my mother to ask if I should drive home. "If you can manage it," she says. I text my father. He says to just wait at school. But I don't want to wait at school. I have spent so many years waiting for people to pick me up from school. Plus, I can drive now, and the last thing I want is to wait. The cars on Wisconsin Avenue move at a snail's pace with blinking hazard lights. The side streets are worse. Meredith and I watch from across the road as Adam and Rowan try to move Rowan's car from its tightly wedged spot on the sloping street near the athletics facilities. Its tires spin on the fresh snow before it lurches forward into the car in front with a sickening crush. Adam shouts, "Holy fucking fuck!" Rowan winds down the window to survey the damage. He drops his head to the steering wheel and screams, "Fuck!" into the thickening white. "Or you could be them," Meredith says from behind her mittened hands. I say, "Lead the way," and follow her up the street as she trudges forward with her tongue stretched out to catch falling flakes. Her hair grows a white coat and then turns deep brown as the snow melts. She wipes her nose on her coat sleeve and sniffles. I think she's beautiful, even if she doesn't know it yet. She has large lips, a wide mouth, and an awkwardly pyramidal nose. She looks like a younger Anne Hathaway. "You should probably kiss her," Adam said to me once as we walked across the cathedral lawn. "She clearly likes you, and honestly, it's not that hard. You just move her to one corner of the dance floor, and then put your mouth on her mouth. Problem solved." Adam is super practical about everything. He's the kind of person who always parks his car in the direction of his house, so he doesn't waste extra time when leaving for home. I said, "I don't think it works like that." "Sure it does," he said. "That's how I did it." "If she likes me, she should kiss me," I said. "It definitely doesn't work like that," Adam said. "Then maybe she doesn't like me." Adam smacked his forehead. A crawling bus packed with miserable-looking people passes us, churning up brown slush in its wake. If the buses are running, there is still a possibility I can take one up to Bradley Boulevard and then walk the last mile home, like I used to do after OJ left for college and before I got my driver's license. It would suck to walk through the snow, especially in my sneakers, but then I'd be home. I stop. "What is it?" Meredith asks. Her whole face is pale, except for the pulsing red at the tip of her nose. "Maybe I should just take the bus home," I say. "The buses are safe." "Fuck that. We're halfway there," Meredith says. "No fucking way." I try to pull away as Meredith grabs me. She slips on the sidewalk and flails her arms as she tries to find her balance. Her momentum pulls us both down, and we laugh, even though the cold snow sneaks into my pants. Meredith is right. What is the point of wasting hours on a crawling bus when a warm house and possibly hot chocolate are so close? Her house is on O Street, set back from the road by sloping flower beds filled with twisted brown remnants of fall flowers and decorative grass. They flank steep stone steps. My mother would approve of its understatedness, especially because it would remind her of London. My father has never understood the logic behind paying so much money for a small place filled with old plumbing in constant need of repair. Even if your neighbors are the senators, cabinet secretaries, and the vast network of unknown but highly influential lobbyists who really run this city. I like the red brick sidewalks and cobblestone streets better than the large lawns and wooded areas between houses where I live. And it's much closer to school. But I guess the grass is always greener. Normally these streets are full of tourists and students, but today they are empty and quiet as the storm settles over the city. I cover my ears with my sleeves as Meredith searches for her keys. "Any day now," I say as she kicks her shoes against the bright red door to clean off the snow. "Everything is always life-threatening," Meredith says, as the meteorologist on television frantically describes the snow that falls around us. She kneels on the living room couch, with her face against the cold window. Her breath fogs the glass. We have eaten turkey and brie sandwiches, because there is nothing else in the fridge and no one will deliver pizza. I understood the turkey, but the brie, with its hard shell, tastes of nothing, and I have never liked its sticky, soft interior. I've told her about the things we eat at home, dried fish that I actually like, and tripe that I avoid by hiding beneath the lip of my plate. And she has made involuntary faces of disgust, followed by an unconvincing, "That's cool, I guess." Her parents were supposed to get back from Houston this evening, but all the airports have shut down, says the enthusiastic meteorologist, as video of snowplows waiting on the runway at Reagan National Airport streams behind him. "Do you want whiskey?" she asks before she disappears from the room. She returns with a bottle of amber liquid, and she pours a little into her hot chocolate. "You can mix it with your hot chocolate. It doesn't taste any different." She takes a sip, and a drop falls from her mug to the couch cushion. She blots it into the fabric, and then looks at me. "You won't get drunk. It's just a drop to help you warm up," she says. I'm not convinced. "If we lived in France," she says. "If we lived in Saudi Arabia," I say. I don't drink because I'm not 21 and because I don't feel the need to drink. My classmates talk about getting wasted at so-and-so's house during their parties on the weekends, but I don't really pay attention. "The risks are too high," OJ tells me. "You aren't like these people," he says. "They can do things that you and I can't do." He never drank, and his classmates loved him. He was voted head prefect. He was the captain of the soccer team. My teachers still call me by his name. I reach for the bottle and remove the cap. I circle my finger around the rubber stop and touch my lips. The alcohol stings at first and then turns sweet, bringing memories of when I was 4 and my father had friends over to watch the Nigerian soccer team in the World Cup. I noticed an unattended glass of Coke, so I quickly gulped it down, hoping to disappear before someone told me not to. It was more than Coke. It burned all the way down my throat into my belly. I felt my mouth grow hot. I yelped and tried to spit out what I hadn't swallowed. The whole room froze. My father's face became an African mask with exaggerated eyes, nostrils, and lips. Then he leapt across the room, grabbed me with one arm, and clapped me on the back with a flat palm. The sound broke the tension and made Dad's friends laugh loudly. They stomped and clapped. It drowned out Dad's shouting at me, "Who told you to come and drink that, eh?" while he pressed my body against the sink and made me swallow round after round of water from his cupped palm until my stomach couldn't hold anything more. I vomited watery brown bile into the white sink and all over the countertop. I haven't touched alcohol since then. Meredith stands and stretches backwards so that her sweater rides up to show the bright flash of her belly button ring. She reaches towards me and says, "Come with me." I follow her to a bedroom on the top floor of the house, where the low eaves make the space feel much smaller than it is. The streetlight filters in through a large circular window and quickly disappears into the nooks and tight spaces. Meredith flops down on a bed with white covers colored orange by the outside light. We listen to the wind and icy snow against the roof, while the treetops outside sway back and forth, making the room feel like it rocks unsteadily. I hold my arms over my chest and massage my triceps through my sleeves. I have been to her house many times before, but never this late, never just the two of us. I know it's every teenage boy's dream, if only for bragging rights in the back corner of the senior lounge, but I hate the way my classmates speak about girls and sex. Their voices sound greedy and untrustworthy. "Neeru?" Meredith says my name like a question. She sits Indian style on the bed with her head tilted to one side. Shadows obscure her face, but her fingernails catch the light every time they slide through her hair. "You can come in, you know. This is where you're going to sleep." I step from the wood floor where my toes curl against the cold, and my feet relax into a soft, warm carpet. I drop to my knees against the bed and lay my head a small distance from Meredith's knee. Her hand hovers in the space just above my cheek, and my jaw tenses, then my back, then my legs, and finally my toes, but she doesn't touch me. She has touched me so many times before, bear hugs, steadying hands, playful slaps while running, but this feels like it will be different. She doesn't touch me. Instead, she tosses her hair to the opposite shoulder and places her hand on her knee. I close my eyes. Why didn't you kiss me in the bishop's garden at homecoming? Why didn't you kiss me? She asks. We'd gone to homecoming together because we just knew we would go together. And at some point between twirling around to shake it off and bouncing to Jumpman, we left the music thumping behind for some quiet in the gardens at the foot of the National Cathedral. There was no moon, and only a smattering of stars above the city as we walked arm in arm across the green. Careful, I said, because the high heels she wore with her short black cocktail dress sank into the soft grass. I held her hand while she removed them, and we walked with our fingers interlocked across the lawn to a gazebo, surrounded by carefully tufted and wilting wild grass. A few yards from the entrance, we saw two figures caressing in the shadows, completely unaware of the rest of the world. Meredith slipped her arm in mine, and we backed away quietly towards the flagstone paths that twisted through the rose bushes and wildflower beds.
It's Miss McConnell,
Meredith giggled when we stopped in the stone nook beneath the gnarled branches of an ancient evergreen. The warm fall weather meant the fountain still gurgled. An oxidized copper sun spat water into a small pool behind a ledge onto which Meredith lowered herself. She pulled me down next to her and swung her legs over mine because she said the stone was too cold against her bare thighs. It didn't feel cold to my palms. She took my jacket and draped it over her shoulders. She said,
"Oh my God, she was totally tongue-fucking that guy."
I searched for a place to put my hands. Meredith's strapless dress threatened to slide down her chest, but she didn't seem to notice or care. I smiled to relieve the burning feeling of foolishness spread across my face. Meredith tensed her legs. Her breath smelled of the cherry dum-dums the student council had dumped into large bins outside the dance hall. She'd been sucking on one when we left the building.
"Just put your mouth on her mouth," Adam said. "It's basic biology."
I put a hand in my pants pocket and hoped Meredith couldn't see me feeling around to make sure that all of my parts remained in their proper places. She leaned in closer. Then she snapped away as footsteps echoed off the stone wall around us. I saw Ms. McConnell first, and then the man following her, holding her hand. Ms. McConnell's mouth fell open as she cocked her head.
"Oh, hey, Miss McConnell," Meredith said.
She slipped my jacket over her bare legs.
"You two know you're not supposed to be in here this late," Miss McConnell said.
She'd released herself from her companion and locked her fingers at her navel. I looked away from the skewed buttons of Miss McConnell's blouse and focused on the dark moss in the cracks between the stones. Miss McConnell quickly folded her arms over her chest.
"You should go back inside, or you should go home," she said.
Meredith stood and finger-waved goodnight. I exhaled.
"Will you kiss me now?"
she asks as she marches her fingers across the space between us on the bed. She cups my face in her hands and gently tilts my head back.
"Okay,"
I say, and close my eyes. Her chapped lips scratch mine. Her breath smells like hot chocolate and whiskey. Her hair tickles my nose. I breathe in and can suddenly smell all of her. The underlying damp from our walk through the snow that lingers in her hair. The turkey and brie on her fingertips. Her tongue searches my lips. It touches my teeth and plays against my tongue before retreating. When it comes back, it's more confident as the rest of her body moves towards mine. Her legs encircle my hips and lock around my lower back. She presses against me and puts her cheek to my cheek before she kisses my neck. I shiver. My hands rise up over her sweater, guided by her hands. Then they are underneath the fabric, my palms against her skin, sweeping up and over her small breasts and hard nipples. She breathes in sharply. I feel my heart,
I hear the rush of my blood. It is this simple. Here, take off your shirt,
Meredith says. Her cold hands push away my turtleneck. My skin prickles. She removes her sweater, her bra, and slides her leggings and panties down to the floor. I have never seen a naked woman in real life. Blue veins trace up and around occasional moles and birthmarks on her otherwise pale skin. She's shaved everything except for a narrow track of brown hair between her legs. Her breasts are larger than I expected, but then I've only seen her wearing a sports bra beneath her t-shirt. She smiles down at me, but her eyes search my face. I feel unsteady in this room of shifting shadows. Snow crackles against the roof. Tree branches beat the siding and scratch the windows. She kisses my neck again. She kisses my chest. Her tongue explores my nipples while her hands fumble with my belt. Desire is desire, our ancient Greek history teacher said once. She is an older woman with wrinkles in wrinkles magnified by oversized lenses that bulge out from awkwardly thin wireframes. She took us to the Smithsonian to see ancient Greek urns painted black with faded orange men and women pleasuring orange men and women under the thrall of Eros, further enabled by Dionysus. For the Greeks, pleasure derived from submission to passion, and passion appeared in many forms. Desire had no right, no wrong. It simply was, she said. Meredith, I whisper. I step back, but her hands follow me, still working against my belt buckle. I grab her wrists and pull them away. No, something's not okay, I say. She falls back onto the bed with her legs firmly pressed together.
No, she says. This is not happening.
Then she is no longer in the room. I wrap my arms around my body. It is suddenly unbearably cold. The white kids used to touch me all the time when I was younger, like they owned me. They'd call me Velcro Head and press things to my hair to see what would stick. I let them play around because there were always more of them than me, and because back then I didn't know the difference between ignorance and malice. Then there was that time one of the girls came up to me after school and asked if she could look down my pants, just a peek, you know, to settle a debate they had after sex ed. I pretended not to hear, but I walked around the rest of the day staring at the floor with my fists clenched. Meredith has left me alone because I will not give her what she wants. But what about what I want? What do I want? More than anything, I want to be home right now, with the thermostat high enough that I can feel comfortable in a t-shirt. I want to smell my mother's chicken pepper soup, her anti-cold weather charm. But there is no way towards that now. Meredith, I hiss her name. In the darkness, it feels like soft voices are more appropriate. I creep along the landing, trying to feel my way, while the house clicks and cracks as it settles around me. I am cold and tense, partly because the joke that the black guy always dies first seems too real in the middle of this rapidly accelerating horror show. Meredith, where are you? I try each of the doorknobs I pass as I make my way towards another set of stairs. They open into a bedroom, a study, and a bathroom, all empty. I move slowly, because it's entirely within Meredith's character to play a practical joke by hiding behind a bed or a door to scare me. She has a harsh sense of humor, especially in difficult situations. Sometimes it makes things better, but mostly it just creates more tension. I'm misunderstood, she likes to say. No, you're just an asshole, I tell her. Dude, it's not funny anymore. This isn't cool, I say. I hear a sniffle behind me and spin around. The landing is still empty. I'm not trying to be funny, she says, but I still can't see anyone. I follow her voice back toward the stairs, up to the guest room, feeling along the wall with my fingertips.
There are no knobs or handles, but my fingers touch a seam in the drywall.
Where are you? I whisper.
Meredith coughs. It's really cold out here, and I think you have my shirt. I say,
fuck your shirt,
she says. But I hear rustling through the wall.
I'm not playing, Meredith. Neither am I.
I shiver and rub my arms. What if her parents come back to find a half-naked black man standing in the middle of their upstairs hallway? This kind of thing never ends well for the black man, no matter how innocent. I really should have driven home. Any accident could not have been more of a wreck than this evening. Meredith groans.
I don't get it. You keep rejecting me, she says.
She sniffles again as she works herself into sobs. I try to swallow, but I can't.
Meredith, it's not...
I can't continue because I don't know what to say. I wish for a steady voice, for some of OJ's confidence, my father's single-mindedness, my mother's calm. I pinch my arms and dig my nails into my own skin and scratch. The burning is relief, the pain a welcome distraction.
Is it my face? She whimpers.
No.
You don't like my body?
No.
I'm not cool enough for you?
I bring my palm to my mouth and bite down against the fleshy pad of my thumb. I raise my knuckles to my lips.
I'm not black enough?
No.
Is it my lack of booty?
Meredith manages a chuckle. No, I say.
Well, what the fuck is wrong with me then?
I've asked myself the very same question since that first time something felt different when I wrestled with Joe, my next-door neighbor, until his father got a job with an aerospace company in San Diego. We threw each other to the carpets and lay down on each other. I felt Joe's breath against my face and neck. His chest moved against my chest, and it felt nice with our legs tangled together.
Because boys aren't supposed to like other boys,
my mother said to me when I asked what the pastor meant when he said America was living under the shadow of that abomination, homosexuality. But OJ likes boys, and I like Joe, I said.
I beg, leave that thing,
my mother said. She only ever speaks pidgin when she's surprised or angry. Otherwise, she sounds faintly British. She fidgeted in the driver's seat and turned up the radio, so I knew she didn't want to talk. She said,
God said man is for woman, and woman is for man. That's how it's supposed to be.
And God was always right. So I decided I would only like girls, even if I could feel that I liked looking at them less than I should. I didn't watch the porn my classmates shared on their phones in the hallways before class or sitting on the lawn in front of the cathedral. At home, I would watch women with women and men with women on my phone, trying only to focus on the women as I touched myself. But those men, their bodies, their sounds, I wanted to gouge out my eyes. Sometimes I asked God for deliverance. Sometimes I held my own breath and circled my hands around my throat and squeezed until they grew tired and I coughed saliva over my lips and onto my chin. Sometimes I cried. When my mother asked me what was wrong, I said homework. She never probed any further. Sometimes when Meredith touched me, when she circled her arms around my neck or pinched my butt, I felt something, but never very strong or for very long. There is nothing wrong with you, I say into the darkness. I slump against the wall and slide to the floor. I say, Meredith, I think I'm gay. She slides the door back and thrusts her head out from the closet. She has wrapped herself in a blanket and her hair covers her face. She says,
What?
She stretches an arm out from the darkness and lets it fall. Then she emerges and envelops me fully in her blanket. She holds me as she murmurs, "I'm right here." She says, "I'm with you." I start to cry. I'm overwhelmed by the sound of my own pain. She tries to slow things down the way our track coaches slow us down. "Count your breaths, Neeru," she says. "Follow my voice, Neeru." I follow for a moment, but my thoughts are strong and I choke on a mixture of relief, embarrassment, and fear. She pulls me closer and rocks with me. She drapes an arm over me and clasps my hand. She says, "I'll always be here." I say, "What do we do now?" Chapter 2. I'm late. The kind of late that suggests I have no regard for the emotional health of my Nigerian parents, who probably think I've been kidnapped by the enemies of progress. To make matters worse, I still can't find my phone, so there is no way to call home and offer excuses. They will worry in their own ways. My mother sunk down in her red lounge chair, trying to focus on patient charts or a medical textbook in her lap, nodding in and out of sleep. My father at the kitchen table, staring with disinterest at whatever food she has set in front of him. But my problem is that they're worrying at all, and that never ends well. For all the years they've lived abroad, they are still so very Nigerian. I can sometimes see the mental strain on their faces when they try to assimilate to some of the more grating aspects of American life. My father doesn't understand the desire to hang out. "What are you hanging from, my friend?" he says. "Do you think that Apple man made his money by hanging out? Talk less of Bill Gates." My father thinks the safest place for a man to be, especially in America, is inside his own house. He relishes coming home, and as soon as he enters our kitchen through the garage door, his anger and stress fall away. He takes off his tie and tosses it on the counter before he grabs a beer from the fridge, and then he is calm. You don't disrupt this routine without profound negative consequences. My not being home will disrupt this routine yet again, especially since I couldn't come home for 2 days during the blizzard, and for the first 12 hours, my parents couldn't reach me after my phone died and the power went out. This is not good. My own routines have been completely busted since I spoke my truth, as Meredith now calls it. I can't seem to remember anything. My body and brain feel numb. At night, I lie awake staring at shadows that float across my ceiling. In the mornings, I forget to take out the trash, and then I forget to bring the bins back up the driveway when I come home at the end of the day. "Is everything okay?" my mother has asked me, and I've mumbled back, "Yeah, I'm fine." But I can tell she doesn't believe me. She's decided to give me some watchful space, because she's a very perceptive woman. She says it comes from having to communicate with the barely verbal and nonverbal children, unwilling teenagers, and frantic parents she sees every day at her practice. She also says she's a woman, that she knows things. "Do you think people can tell I've changed?" I've asked Meredith over and over again, before class, after class, in our Snapchats long after we've gone home. "Do you think they know?" I asked her one afternoon as we sat in our special place beneath the buttress. It was still too cold to be outside, but the start of track season meant the unofficial start of spring, where people believe acting like the world is warm will suddenly make the world warm. She asked, "Has anyone said anything to you?" No one had said a word to me, but that was almost beside the point. "You need an outlet," Meredith said, and plucked a blade of grass from the ground. The new track season also meant a return to the crowded locker room full of half-naked boys and their banter, their bodies. I'm no stranger to locker room antics. Hiding clothes, shower wrestling, pantsing people, twisting nipples. I know that someone will slap or grab my ass and pretend to ride me. Now, I don't know how I'll respond, or if that response will be involuntary, and that scares me. But you've probably always been gay. And if no one has said anything for the last 18 years, then why would they say anything now? Meredith said.
It just feels different now, Meredith. Before I said it out loud, I could pretend I didn't know, I said. But speaking the words out loud, I feel like I've let something loose that I can't control.
You definitely need an outlet, she said. If only so you'll stop asking me the same question over and over again.
And she tossed me my phone. The lock screen was filled with Grindr alerts and Tinder notifications.
What the fuck did you do?
I asked as I fumbled the catch and it dropped to the grass.
You're welcome, Meredith said. You forgot your phone in Miss McConnell's class. I just took the liberty to install a couple apps. You can delete them if you want. Or you can check it out. It can't hurt, can it?
She crossed her arms and stared into one of the halogen lights buzzing in its casing. I slipped the phone into my pocket.
Come on, I said. We're late for practice.
At a stoplight, I rummaged through a stack of old papers and cassette tapes in the glove box. I sweep my hand between the seats but feel only years of crumbs and old popcorn kernels in the creases. They stick beneath my fingernails, a testament to the earlier days when my mother used to drive OJ and me to school. She likes Volvos because her mother liked Volvos and because they are safe. OJ drove this car before he went to college, and now I drive it. I'm forced to burn my music onto CDs because there's no tape deck and it doesn't have an auxiliary cable port. Meredith calls the cracked black leather seats distressed. I dream of a BMW. I slam the glove box closed and try to breathe against a growing panic. I was late to class because I searched this car for 15 minutes looking for my phone. It's now a liability and has been from the moment I didn't delete the apps Meredith installed. More important, I need it now to call and broker peace with my parents. But it's nowhere to be seen.
You can just delete them,
Meredith said as we sat in my car after practice. But I've always been curious, and there is also desire. I looked at my phone and felt the tingling creep, the stiffness rising. Pick someone for me, I said. So she swiped and tapped and picked Ryan with his short twists and aggressively attractive bleach-white smile. His profile pictures showed him suspended in various forms of dance, in various stages of undress above the caption, "Movement is life."
Oh, match, she squealed. See, it's easy. Now all you have to do is go.
Ryan's avatar texted me the next day. We can have coffee and then whatever. I texted back, sure, completely uncertain of what I'd just done. Coffee, I understood, but the whatever rattled around my head. The word sounded so much like the whatever Reverend Olumide railed against from the pulpit on Sundays.
You have kids saying whatever, doing whatever, whatever, whatever. And then they have boyfriends or babies, yes? They find themselves experimenting with lesbianism and homosexuality and all manner of unclean things.
I am not unclean, I say aloud as I barrel down 16th Street, but I'm not convinced. I haven't done anything yet, I say to myself. I ran away from doing something.
Temptation must always come,
Reverend Olumide says almost every service.
Sin will never go away, he shouts. It's for you not to go toward it.
I pick up speed. It's late enough that traffic is light and the remaining cars move freely. I pass our church and its stone lions out in front of the entrance. Then the Carter Barron Amphitheater nestled inside the woods of Rock Creek Park. There are fewer lights up ahead, so I press down on the gas.
Maybe you forgot it at home,
Meredith said as we walked down to the track earlier that afternoon. Our warm-up pants swished with each step, and a gray sky threatened rain. At lunch, I looked around at all the track team members silently praying for thunderstorms while we ate salads in advance of the season's first speed workout. I hadn't eaten much because of the workout, but also because of nervousness.
Ryan's text beneath his smiling face flickered before me. Coffee and whatever. I'm actually going to do this. Niru is actually going to do this, I repeated to myself. And why not? It was just a quick meetup, coffee after practice, and then home. There wasn't going to be any time for whatever. I didn't forget it, I said. I could swear I had it with me this morning when I got in the car. Maybe it's a sign. Maybe I'm not supposed to go. What if it's like God's way of telling me that he's a serial killer or he has AIDS? Because the probability of both of those things is so high, Meredith said. Reverend Olumide would say so. Or you could just go and see what happens, Meredith said. I felt completely unclean by the time I stopped the car at 14th and U. I couldn't shower after practice, so I was conscious of my own smell as I watched the yuppies trooping home from the metro station. They hurried past the homeless men with their bags and shopping carts and avoided the puddles collecting in the potholes and dips at the intersection. I don't have to do this, I told myself. I don't have to sit behind those rain-streaked windows with my fingers inches away from another man's fingers and the threat of whatever hanging between us. I could still go back. I could still repackage whatever had been let loose by my telling Meredith and go home to an uncomplicated life with my Harvard early admission and two proud parents. I could go to church on Sunday and beg forgiveness for this temporary submission to wayward thoughts, and for the strength to resist the ever-present temptation. No one would know. It wouldn't be cowardice. It wouldn't be running away. It would be the textbook example of taking the hard right over the easy wrong. I rummaged around the driver's side pocket. The right thing to do would have been to send a text bowing out. I'm so sorry, my car broke down. Then I could delete the app and forget the last few weeks, except that my body wouldn't let me leave. I watched the entrance to the cafe from across the street, where a flow of young and attractive men, arm in arm with women in their skinny jeans and high heels, even in this rain, streamed in and out. I should have this too, I thought. I saw Ryan walk up the block. He was shorter than I expected, but he moved with real confidence. He bounced through each step, presumably to the rhythm of the song playing through large red headphones straddling his head. I gripped the wheel. My skin buzzed. If only whatever could happen without any impact on the rest of my life. But that's why we dream. I started the car. Now I pass houses on 16th Street that sit quietly, softly lit in the night. My parents considered living in this area when they first moved to Washington, in one of these affordable large brick homes surrounded by other black faces, near other black families with black kids also enrolled in the city's private schools. My mother would have been closer to Children's Hospital, where she has admitting privileges, and she liked the idea of a larger, connected community. But my father wanted more space and more prestige. My father likes to say that he lives in the same neighborhood as Ted Koppel. He likes the seclusion and the horse trail separating the properties. It drives me crazy because it means I have to get up that much earlier to beat slow drivers on the scenic single-lane roads. Normally it means fighting the same people who don't want to get home after work. But at this time of night, I can fly down the stretches of road between speed cameras to make up time. My rearview mirror flashes with light from another car's high beams, and then the darkness behind me pulses with red and blue lights. Shit, I yell. Fuck me. There's no escaping this. Not at 25 miles over the speed limit, after rush hour with fewer cars on the road. One of my classmates likes to brag about how he outsmarted the police after running a red light on the way home from a party over the weekend. He was going too fast for even the police to catch up and turned onto the first available side street into the first available driveway, then quickly turned off his car. The police drove right by. But George Gilbert Monson Jr. has blonde hair, blue eyes, and a wealthy father who can afford his foolishness. I only have a wealthy father who won't subsidize mine. I pull to the shoulder, turn on my overhead lights, and place my hands on the steering wheel. Never take your hands off that wheel, O.J. said to me last Thanksgiving when he was stopped while driving my father's Range Rover on the way to buy extra chicken for my mother's pepper soup. Three police cars pulled into the Safeway parking lot as he tried to get into the car. They approached him with their weapons out and made him lie face down on the wet ground while they cuffed him in front of everybody. O.J. said that if our next-door neighbor hadn't walked by, he's sure that he'd have been in jail or maybe dead. But also, I kept my hands visible, he said. Always keep your hands in sight. They told him just before they left that someone had called to describe a black man trying to boost luxury cars from the village parking lot. In broad daylight on Thanksgiving? Well, you never know, the police said. Stay calm, I tell myself. Breathe easy, breathe slow. My hands tremble as I watch a black officer approach through the rearview mirror. A white officer approaches from the passenger side. Evening, son. I'm Officer Williams. I need to see your license and registration, the officer says. His white partner at the passenger door crosses his arms over his chest. I'm so sorry, officer, I say. I know I was speeding. I'm just really late getting home. Well, you might be a little bit later, he says. Your license and registration. My license is in my wallet, which is in my sports bag, which is in the trunk where I tossed it after practice. Your license and registration, young man. I open the door and it bumps the officer. He steps backwards. The white officer raises his head, but his eyes are bored. He picks at his fingernails while looking through the passenger window. Son, what are you doing? Officer Williams says. Can you please put your hands back on the wheel? I put my hands on the wheel. I'm really sorry, I say. My license is in my bag, in the trunk. Officer Green, you can step back from the vehicle, please, Officer Williams says. Young man, I want you to take the keys out of your ignition and toss them out the window. Can you do that for me? My keys jangle as they hit the ground. Now, you can open your door from the outside. I want to see your hands. Keep them visible for me as you exit your vehicle. I push open the door with my foot and step onto the wet asphalt. The air smells of wet leaves and damp earth. I squint against the headlights of the police car. Officer Williams says, Now, I'm going to hand you these keys, and you can open your trunk nice and slowly for me. I pop my trunk open. My backpack sits atop a mess of empty CD cases and used towels that I meant to wash weeks ago. I reach for my bag. Can I take it out? I ask. Slowly, he says. I remove my wallet and hand my license to the officer. You can shut the trunk, he says. Go back and sit in your car. I'm not here. This isn't happening. A ticket will only add fuel to the possible fire already smoldering at home.
Niru, you are irresponsible. You are careless. You this boy. You don't think. Jesus.
My father will shout in a tone that makes you feel like the whole world is disappointed by your birth. These are the moments when I'm almost positive that my parents never meant to have me. The perfect O.J. would have been just fine for them on his own. I'd always wondered why there was such a big gap between me and O.J., that maybe I was an accident. Then my mother told me that I actually had a sister born too prematurely to survive more than a few hours after birth.
That's when your father started going to church more, she said. We didn't have a proper funeral. She was too young.
My father has never said a word about it. The night air is cold against my face. I should have stayed. Then Ryan and I would be on our way to doing whatever, and at least being late would be worth it.
You can go now,
Officer Williams says as he hands back my license through the car window. In the rear view, I see Officer Green sitting in the squad car's passenger seat. He fills the whole space with his body. Officer Williams says, "Listen, since you don't have any tickets or previous violations, we'll just forget that this whole thing happened. You get home now, but no more speeding, you hear?" I nod, but my hands won't stop shaking. My father sits at the kitchen table waiting when I open the door. There is a placemat, but no food in front of him, and the space between the silver fork and knife is occupied by a small black rectangle that I know is my phone. I swallow. "Good evening, Daddy," I say. My father says nothing for a long time. He grinds his teeth and drums his fingers on the table. This man that usually has so much to say about everything in his deep, imposing voice and gravelly Nigerian accent is silent. I'm scared.
"Who is Ryan?"
he asks as he removes his glasses. I have not seen him like this before. Angry, yes. Confused, only once, but never both together. My father's hands shake as he tries to control himself. He is all power, all will. He's the one who reminds us constantly that if he could walk 10 miles to get sardines and tinned tomatoes for his family during the war, dodging low-flying Nigerian fighter planes that made a sport of strafing hungry refugees, then there is nothing he or we can't do. But he can't control this.
"Kwamniru, I'm asking you to tell me what is this?"
he shouts, and his voice rises an octave with each word that leaves his mouth. His eyes narrow until they are colored only by red veins. His eyes are like that because he grew up in the dust, he says. Even America can't change that. When I was younger, he would invert his eyelids to reveal the pink membrane beneath with its streaking capillaries. Then he would chase me from room to room, laughing. I wasn't always certain that the monster behind me was really my father, so I cried. Then my father would hold me and offer me ice cream. My mother didn't like that. She says children don't like uncertainty.
"Am I really seeing what my eyes are seeing?"
he shouts as he holds up my phone. I can make out Tinder alerts that I should have turned off. I don't know why I didn't. "I can explain," I say.
"Explain what?"
he shouts and sprays a mist of saliva with the words he expels from his mouth.
"What will you explain? Who and who are you explaining to? My friend, keep quiet. Does your mother know about this filth you want to explain?"
He slams the phone down on the table. I wince. The glass vase at its center, which now holds glass pens, some coins, receipts, and sheets of paper that no one knows what to do with, shakes, and the coins inside rattle.
"Does your mother know? I have to tell your mother. I have to tell her that this is what her son has been doing. I never should have let your mother name you. I told her, we don't give men that kind of name. But she insisted that it had to be this name. The disgrace."
I remain frozen midway between the kitchen door and the kitchen table. I want to grab the phone and break it into tiny pieces, but I can't move.
"Ify,"
my father shouts.
"Ify, are you in this house? Come see what your son is doing. Are you in this house?"
My mother's Mercedes was in the garage when I came in, but I didn't smell any food. There's a faint odor of the trash I should have taken to the curb this morning, and one of the countertops has just been sprayed with Lysol, but there is no pepper scent, no home-baked butter loaf, or any of the things she made every once in a while to remind herself that she actually could have gone to culinary school like she wanted, instead of medical school like my grandfather demanded.
"In my house, in this house,"
my father shouts,
"you want to bring this kind of sinful, satanic rubbish into my house? To Fiakwa, it can never happen."
He takes two steps toward me with the phone in his right hand before he turns around and stomps into the family room where he closes his left fist around the thorny switch of a bougainvillea twisted across the mantel.
Iffy!
He shouts up to the landing a floor above, but my mother still doesn't answer.
I told your mother. I told that woman that we should have sent you to school in Nigeria, not this useless place. How can a son of mine do this? My son? No, it can never happen.
Then he charges back into the kitchen and is suddenly so close that I can smell the honey-roasted peanuts on his breath. He has only been home a few minutes, and his tie still hangs from his white collar. There is a ketchup stain near the knot, and I know it has probably bothered him the whole day. He is the kind of man who always wears white shirts, who cares about appearances. Before a man leaves his house each morning, he should be washed, lotioned, and dressed in smart clothing. You have to pay attention to these things, he says. Otherwise, people will think you have no parents. He grabs my ear.
Daddy!
I yelp as he twists and pulls me forward.
You want to go and do gay marriage? Is that what you want? You want to go and carry man, put your thing for his nyash? Abomination! Abomination!
He pushes my face down into the kitchen table. A salty warmth fills my cheek. My tongue burns.
Daddy, let me tell you-
Tell me what? Tell me how you want to go and collect shame and disgrace for this family? Tell me how you want to go and do all sorts of despicable, filthy, unnatural and unclean things? How can- No, you want to kill me?
The pain spreads from my cheek up to my eyes and into my forehead. My tears pool as I try to blink away the stinging feeling in my nose. I want to sneeze, but I can't sneeze. I want to swallow, but I can't swallow through my constricted throat. My father lets go of me and backs away to the wall.
You stupid child. You are going back to Nigeria pronto, immediately, sharp.
Daddy, you're over-
I'm over what? See this boy with the audacity to open his filthy mouth and say what to me? No, you are going back to Nigeria. I will personally escort you to Holy Spirit Chapel or Mountain of Fire or whichever one so we can burn this sinful nonsense from your body.
I'm overreacting.
Open your mouth and say it again.
He launches a half-hearted slap toward me, but lets his hand drop to his side.
Do you know what you have done? Do you know what this means? Are you really telling me the truth that you are going out and gallivanting with the gays, the homosexuals? Where did you learn this kind of behavior? Is it in school? Is this what are they teaching you? I'm going to call your headmaster right now. I need to speak to that your headmaster immediately. Then I am buying your ticket home. We will pull you out of school and send you back to Nigeria for spiritual revival.
Daddy, listen to me, I say. He straightens against the wall and his shoulder knocks the frame of one of my mother's market scene photos. It settles into a listing position. He rubs his shoulder.
I'm listening, he says softly.
Upstairs, the toilet flushes, sending water through the pipes. My father and I look up and then at each other. I can feel my heart separate from the rest of my body. I want to hand it to the frothing old man in front of me and say, take it. It's yours. Because it has always been yours. If not for your sperm, your food, and the school fees that you pay on my behalf, then who and where would I be? Nothing. I am because you are. I say nothing. Each word I search for flies from my brain before I can send it off my tongue. Then his hands are around my neck, pushing and shaking me. My ears begin to ring, and I can hear myself scream even as my father's shouts grow louder in my ears. It fills my whole body with burning. His hands tighten as spittle beads on his lips. His wedding ring chafes my skin, and I wish it would sever something that can end this immediately. If there is anything like a bright spot
It's imagining what he will do when that first spurt of blood erupts from my throat and splatters on the ceiling. But maybe he will smile at having done the Lord's work to rid the world of such abominable evil. Maybe he will